Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader today. I'll be reading articles from the March 2025 issue of the Smithsonian Magazine. I hope you enjoy the program today. I'm going to begin with an article that's a sequel to an article I read in last week's program. That article was called Taking the Lead: How Alice Hamilton Waged a One-Woman Campaign Against a Toxic and Ubiquitous Material. Obviously, this short sequel relates to the element lead. The title is Element of Surprise. Cultures throughout history have put lead to use in wacky and often deeply poisonous ways, by Sonia Anderson. The first example is lead-acene. Upper-class men and women in ancient Egypt commonly defined their eyes with kohl, a dark powder made from lead sulfide. Strangely, the makeup seems to offer protection from common eye infections. Recognizing this, Egyptians may have synthesized the lead cosmetic specifically to enhance its medicinal properties. In 2009, modern chemists actually tested the toxic remedy's effectiveness by mixing lead salts with human skin cells. Sure enough, the lead-affected cells produced more immune response chemicals, preventing infection. Number two, all roads lead to Rome. Though Romans famously channeled water through lead pipes, that water might not have been their main problem. Mountain streams were rich in calcium, which coated the pipes in a layer that may have prevented lead from entering the water. In fact, historians think Romans likely got their daily dose of lead through a different beverage. Boiling syrups, like sapa, in lead cauldrons contaminated their sweetened wines. Drinkers could experience psychosis, anemia, and fertility problems. Number three, Age of Bronze, Age of Lead. China's Bronze Age was oddly rich in lead. Up to 4,000 years ago in the Yellow River Valley, craftspeople were smelting tin, copper, and lead into bronze goblets, and Shang Dynasty nobles drank rich wine from these ornate cups. Modern scientists tested the potential effects of drinking such an acidic spirit from a toxic metal, and found that one drinker's daily lead intake would have been as high as 85 micrograms, enough to cause chronic lead poisoning, aka plumbism. Number three, coining a malady. Ancient Greeks made their coins by extracting silver from lead-rich ore. Greeks' mining and smelting operations ended up seriously polluting Earth's atmosphere, as modern scientists have confirmed via buried deposits in Greenlandic glaciers of lead dust that blew over from Greece long ago. In the 2nd century BC, the physician Nicander of Colophon was the first to record nausea, fatigue, and delusions as symptoms of severe plumbism. And lastly, lick of paint. Between the 15th and 20th centuries, lead pigments were used in white paint, and they became so common in oil paints that artists' plumbism symptoms were commonly referred to as painter's colic. The Dutch artist Vincent van Gogh suffered psychological maladies throughout his life, but his infamous ear-cutting delirium might have been exacerbated by plumbism. He had a well-known habit of licking the tip of his paintbrush. And that completes the article Element of Surprise by Sonia Anderson. Our next article is titled Best Case Scenario, the cutting-edge design that safeguarded treasures on their way back from the moon, by Ilana Shearer. It's only the size of a suitcase, 8 by 19 by 11.7 inches, perfect for the overhead storage bin on a passenger aircraft. It's even shaped like luggage, with a hinged lid and a side-mounted handle. But instead of being lugged home full of socks and souvenirs, this special carry-on came home with the Apollo astronauts, full of moon. Its official name is the Apollo Lunar Sample Return Container, number 1008. But everyone, including Teasel Muir Harmony, curator of the Apollo collection at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, calls it and its handful of followers rock boxes because of what they do: ferry samples from the lunar surface to a laboratory back on Earth. The Apollo missions landed on the moon 6 different times between 1969 and 1972, and on each occasion, among their other duties, the astronauts were tasked with collecting various bits of the lunar environment, rocks, dust, even core samples. And however humble-looking, these chunks and powders gave scientists on Earth a closer look at some of the deepest mysteries of space: how the universe was formed, how to determine the age of planets, how comets and asteroids can change the composition of a planetary body. As we go around the center of the galaxy, the local conditions change, says Ryan Ziegler, lunar sample curator at NASA. Ziegler says the weather, tectonics, and magnetic field of the Earth make it difficult to measure things like the universe's radiation. You need to go to one of these airless bodies like the moon and find old rocks from maybe 250 million years ago, and then you can understand how our whole solar system evolves. And just as those lunar samples have proved crucial to our understanding of the universe, the box design itself offers unparalleled insight into the Apollo program. Every detail on the container, from its polished exterior to the chain mail-like mesh inside, shows how the Apollo team tapped brilliant minds to solve problems large and small. Looking beyond the program's biggest names, we can learn about lesser-known innovators, such as Yvonne Clark, known as YY, an inventive black mechanical engineer who worked as a NASA contractor in the mid-1960s. Clark was so proud of her work on the rock boxes and Saturn rockets that she encouraged her family to watch every Apollo launch to see her designs in action. The box might look simple, but it had a delicate task. The samples needed to survive huge swings in temperature while being brought aboard the lunar module. On the trip back to Earth, even in the relative safety of the module, the materials would be subject to harsh vibrations. The rock box also needed to hold a vacuum to protect its contents from Earth contamination, but also to protect Earth in case there were dangerous elements lurking in the moon dust. The astronauts also needed a box they could manipulate while wearing a bulky spacesuit. To meet these needs, the team designed the case with a T-bar and two big toggle levers, which make it possible to open and latch the box even while wearing insulated gloves. To prevent leaks, the box was fitted with temperature-resistant O-rings, and what's called a knife edge seal, where a rigid blade meets a softer metal and cuts into it, providing airtight containment. NASA had many partners during the development of Project Apollo, and when the time came to manufacture the elegantly designed rock boxes, the team turned to the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission, where containing hazardous materials was a specialty. The boxes were cast, machined, and assembled by Union Carbide Corporation's Nuclear Division at Y-12 in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, which was under contract with NASA at the time. The Oak Ridge site created 16 rock boxes for NASA, and number 1008 was used in December 1969 by Pete Conrad and Alan L. Bean during the Apollo 12 moon landing. Muir Harmony says that because NASA kept impeccable records, we know that this box was deployed during the second of two moonwalks, and that the mission brought home a combined 75 pounds of samples that continue to offer insights for scientists around the world. The rock box is a great example of problem solving, says Muir Harmony, adding that scientists still look to the Apollo program for inspiration in creating tools for space exploration. Ziegler agrees, noting that Mars rovers are now collecting samples in tubes that use a similar knife-edge sealing technology to that of the Apollo boxes. The universe remains full of mystery, but we learn a little more from each mission, bringing back answers one small box at a time. And that's the end of the article. The title was Best Case Scenario by Ilana Shearer. This article is titled Dancer, Singer, Actress, Spy. A newly available memoir reveals a tender, private side of Josephine Baker by Kayla Randall. Before she was a legend, Josephine Baker was a little girl from Missouri who loved to make funny faces. Teachers chided her for this habit. Baker paid them little heed. "Our faces aren't made to sleep," she later said. Baker's life was so full that it's easy to imagine she never slept. Born in 1906, Baker became one of the 20th century's biggest celebrities, known as the Black Venus, an enthralling dancer and singer whose career took off when she left the United States as a teenager for France, where she eventually became a citizen. She toured the globe and became the first black woman to star in a major film, Siren of the Tropics, in 1927. During World War II, she spied for the French resistance against the Nazis. She was also a fierce fighter for civil rights in America and memorably addressed the crowd at the 1963 March on Washington. A rare intimate picture of Baker emerges in her memoir, Fearless and Free, originally published in France in 1949 and now translated into English for the first time. The book peels back the myth to bring readers the high-spirited child who grew up poor on Bernard Street in St. Louis, brought home lost animals, and made faces in school. An early and urgent drive, she says, was to help others. "I promised myself that when I was strong," she said, "I would fight everyone who was mean to the poor, whether they were kings or not." That completes the article, Dancer, Singer, Actress, Spy, by Kayla Randall. This title is called Urtext, that's E-U-R, text, the genesis of an informal medium that took over Our Vernacular by Scott Nover. On December 3, 1992, in Newbury, England, computer scientist Neil Papworth texted two words, Merry Christmas, to Richard Jarvis, a Vodafone engineering director who was across town at a Christmas party. This simple holiday greeting between colleagues was, in fact, a landmark event in the history of telecommunications. Papworth had just sent the first text message. Texting, in the broadest sense, that is, electrically sending words back and forth between people, had arguably been around for nearly 150 years, since Samuel F.B. Morse unveiled his telegram. But on that wintry English eve, texting began its journey to the heart of our daily experience. Of course, phones still had to catch up. The device Papworth used, the Orbital 901, an early mobile phone with a blockish and unlovely LCD screen, was a behemoth, a corded clunker that more closely resembled a contemporary landline than a modern cell phone. In a way, we've been waiting for SMS, or short message service, the form of texting that Papworth introduced, since Donald Murray added a typewriter keyboard to the telegraph around 1901 to create the teletype machine, which transmitted messages over electrical lines for a small fee, usually at a telegraph or post office. The telex service, which operated over telephone lines, was in operation in Germany as early as 1927 and spread globally in the years after World War II. Telex fell out of favor by the 1970s as fax machines rose in popularity, followed by early computer email systems. As the decades went along, we inched closer and closer to uninhibited electronic text messaging, a day Thomas Edison had foreseen with remarkable accuracy as early as 1878. In the future, Edison wrote in an essay, everyday people would send voice messages back and forth using his phonograph in tandem with the newly invented telephone. The dictation may be as rapid as the thoughts can be formed or the lips utter them. It was a vision of leisure, offering the ease of letter writing at the speed of the telephone. That blend of casual simplicity came to an apex in text messaging. Today, the pinnacle of convenience is immediate yet asynchronous communication, sending a message when you're available and waiting for the recipient to respond whenever they can. In recent years, the rise of voice notes, transmissible by text, has arguably brought us even closer to Edison's original prediction. Meanwhile, text shorthand continues to overrun our vernacular. TTYL. That completes the article, Text, by Scott Nover. I'll close the program today with this article from the online edition of the Smithsonian. The title, How a Stuffed Animal Named Billy Possum Tried and Failed to Replace the Teddy Bear as America's National Toy, by Howard Dora. If teddy bear, why not Billy Possum? That was the question posed by a political cartoon in the January 10, 1909 issue of the Atlantic Constitution. Inspired by a highly anticipated Possums and Taters banquet that the Atlanta Chamber of Commerce was hosting for incoming President William Howard Taft, the cartoon told the teddy bear to beat it, and declared Billy Possum the new national toy. It might seem ridiculous to suggest that the beloved teddy bear, named for the story of Theodore Roosevelt's refusal to shoot a restrained bear, could be replaced by a plush version of the 18-pound possum served to Taft for dinner on January 15th. But where most people saw a joke, wealthy Georgia widow Susie Wright Allgood saw a serious business opportunity. She would take Billy Possum from Georgia all the way to Broadway and the New York Supreme Court, and within 6 months, she would find the answers to the question, why not Billy Possum? Allgood and her son Andrew P. Allgood, a Wall Street broker, quickly formed the Georgia Billy Possum Company, with an office in the Flatiron Building in New York City. Within a week, Allgood met with patent lawyers, designers, and manufacturers to get possum toys into production in time for Taft's March 4th inauguration. She planned for each Georgia delegate to wear a little Billy Possum in the parade. Then Allgood went to work charming the press, quickly becoming the storm center of the possum fad. In the words of the Tennessee Journal and Tribune, she demurely referred to herself as just a plain Georgia cracker. But outlets like the Journal and Tribune disagreed, calling the 49-year-old a remarkable woman in more respects than one, the gods having looked upon her with especial favor and partiality, with their gifts of wealth and beauty. In 1896, the Constitution had reported that she was notably one of the most beautiful women in the South. Press coverage of Billy Possum didn't delve into Allgood's tragic past, but it would have been familiar to Atlanta readers. An 1898 article in the Constitution noted that Allgood's personal experiences with loss had uniquely prepared her for her volunteer work during the Spanish-American War, when she attended to wounded soldiers and consoled mothers who'd lost their sons. In 1890, Allgood's husband, cotton mill owner DeForest Allgood, was murdered by his sister's husband, leaving his wife to care for their two young children. One of those sons, 5-year-old DeForest Jr., died of croup 3 years later. Allgood fully dedicated herself to the success of Billy Possum. She faced a weird duality, says Angel Qualick Folland, a historian at the University of Florida. The possum thing is an interesting mix because it's a soft toy, which is for kids, except it's also for politics. You have this national resonance with the political scene. In 1909, Allgood couldn't vote. She couldn't even attend the possum dinner that inspired her business. But here she was, launching a toy as ambitious as she was. A toy the Constitution predicted to be the petted darling of young America, the fad of the modish woman, and the mascot of the incoming administration. Both Allgood and her son Andrew came up with some innovative ideas to market Billy Possum. Most of the publicity was handled with live possums, under the bold assumption that seeing the creature in person would help. Billy Possum's first stop was Broadway. In an early form of influencer marketing, Allgood arranged for a live possum to appear on stage with Anna Held, Broadway's most popular musical comedy star. The actress was a pioneer of publicity stunts and product endorsement. Fans could buy Held-branded corsets, face powders, and cigars. She had previously appeared on stage with life-size teddy bears, so she was the perfect choice to reveal the stuffed animal's successor. Held walked out with the possum during the last verse of her number, I've Lost My Little Brown Bear, a surprise said to bring down the house. Meanwhile, Andrew was working behind the scenes to popularize the possum in his own way. According to the press, he put together a real possum party at the King Edward Hotel in New York for the chorus girls of the Queen of the Moulin Rouge, a risque show with song titles like The Pleasure Brigade and Take That Off, Too. The evening kicked off with a christening party where two live possums were dipped into a punch bowl of champagne. This was followed by a supper of pickled possum, possum soup, roast possum, and possum pudding, and capped off by a kissing party where each girl paid her respects to the surviving possums, a wire service reported. The publicity stunt inspired headlines like, "Possum meat am good to eat," "Say girlies sweet," but the stories failed to mention the All Goods Company or its stuffed toy. And with that, I'm afraid we have run out of time. Obviously, the possum ended up not replacing the teddy bear as America's national toy. The name of the article was How a Stuffed Animal Named Billy Possum Tried and Failed to Replace the Teddy Bear as America's National Toy. This has been the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader today. I hope you enjoyed the program today. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with its premium programming offered on a 24/7 basis. And if you've missed an article you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then click on the words Demand Podcasts. You'll see a list of articles available to you. Hopefully, you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.